Robin said. No, thank you, but we can't. We're staying in the tower. Abel arched an eyebrow.
All of you.
What he meant.
Can you make that decision? Can you tell me everyone in there wants to die?
And he was right to ask. Because no, Robin could not speak for all 7 remaining scholars. In fact, he realized he had no idea what they would choose to do next. I'll ask, he said, chastened. How long?
Within the hour, said Abel. Sooner if you can. Would rather not tarry.
Robin steeled himself a moment before going back upstairs. He didn't know how to tell them this was the end. His face kept threatening to crumple, to reveal the scared boy hiding behind the ghost of his older brother. He had roped all these people into this last stand. He could not bear the sight of their faces when he told them it was over. Everyone was on the 4th floor, clustered at the east window. He joined them. Outside, soldiers were marching forth on the lawn, advancing at an oddly hesitant pace. What are they doing? Wondered Professor Kraft. Is this a charge? You'd think they'd charge with more of them, said Victoire. She had a point. More than 12 troops had halted on High Street, but only 5 soldiers proceeded the rest of the way towards the tower. As they watched, the soldiers parted, and a solitary figure stepped through their ranks up to the final remaining barricade. Victoire drew in a sharp breath. It was Letty. She waved a white flag. Chapter 32. She sate upon her dobie to watch the evening star, and all the punkers as they passed cried, "My, how fair you are." Edward Lear, the Cummerbund. They sent everyone else upstairs before they opened the door. Letty was not here to negotiate with the crowd. They would not have sent an undergraduate to do so. This was personal. Letty was here for a reckoning. Let her through, Robin told Abel.
Pardon?
She's here to talk. Tell them to let her through. Abel spoke a word to his man, who ran across the green to inform the barricaders. 2 men climbed on top of the barricade and bent down. A moment later, Letty was lifted over the top, then lowered none too gently down onto the other side. She made her way across the green, shoulders hunched, flag trailing behind her on the pavement. She did not raise her eyes until she met them at the threshold.
Hello, Letty, said Victoire.
Hello,
Letty murmured.
Thank you for seeing me.
She looked miserable. She had clearly not been sleeping. Her clothes were dirty and rumpled, her cheeks hollow, and her eyes red and puffy from crying. The way she hunched her shoulders around her, as if flinching from a blow, made her look very small. And despite himself, despite everything, all Robin wanted then was to give her a hug. This instinct startled him. As she'd approached the tower, he'd entertained, briefly, the thought of killing her. If only her death did not doom them all. If only he could just throw his own life into the bargain. But it was so hard to look at her now and not see a friend. How could you love someone who had hurt you so badly? Up close, staring her in the eyes, he had trouble believing that this Letty, their Letty, had done the thing she had. She looked grief-stricken, vulnerable, the wretched heroine of a terrible fairy tale. But that, he reminded himself, was the advantage of the image Letty occupied. In this country, she had the face and colouring that inspired sympathy. Among them, no matter what happened, Letty alone could walk out of here innocent. He nodded at her flag. Here to surrender?
Here to negotiate, she said. That's all.
Then come in, said Victoire.
Letty, invited, stepped through the door. It slammed shut behind her. For a moment, the 3 of them only looked at each other. They stood uncertain in the middle of the lobby, an unbalanced triangle. It felt so fundamentally wrong. There had always been 4 of them. They had always come in pairs, an even set. And all Robin could think of was the acute absence of Rami among them. They were not themselves without him, without his laughter,
his quick, easy wit, his sudden turns of conversation that made them feel like they were spinning plates. They were no longer a cohort. Now they were only awake. Victoire asked, in a flat and toneless voice, "Why?" Letty flinched, but only just barely. "I had to," she said, chin high, unwavering. "You know it's all I could have done." "No," said Victoire. "I don't. I couldn't betray my country." "You didn't have to betray us. You were in the thrall of a violent criminal organization," said Letty. The words came out so smoothly Robin could only assume they had been rehearsed. "And unless I pretended I agreed with you, unless I played along, I didn't see how I was going to get out of there alive." Did she truly believe that? Robin wondered. Was that how she'd always seen them? He couldn't believe these words were coming out of her mouth. That this was the same girl who'd once stayed up late with them, laughing so hard their ribs had ached. Only Chinese had a character that encapsulated how much simple words could hurt. Si, the character for thorns, for stabs, for criticism. Such a flexible character. In a phrase,
刺言刺语,
it meant barbed, stinging words. Si could mean to goad. Si could also mean to murder. "So what's this then?" Robin asked. "Parliament's had enough."
"Oh, Robin."
Letty gave him a plaintive look.
"You need to surrender."
"I'm afraid that's not how negotiation works, Letty."
"I mean it. I'm trying to warn you. They don't even want me to be here, but I begged them. I wrote to my father. I pulled every string I had."
"Warn us about what?" Victoire asked. "They're going to storm the tower at dawn. And they're going to destroy your resistance with guns. No more waiting. It's over." Robin crossed his arms. "Good luck with getting their city back then."
"But that's just it," said Letty. "They've held back because they thought they could starve you out. They don't want you dead. Believe it or not, they don't like shooting at scholars. You're all very useful. You're right about that. But the country can't stand it anymore. You've pushed them to the edge."
"Seems like the logical thing then would be to agree to our demands," said Victoire.
"You know they can't do that. They're going to destroy their own city. Do you think Parliament cares what you destroy?"
Letty demanded, impatient.
"Those men aren't bothered about what you're doing to Oxford or to London. They laughed when the lights went dark, and they laughed when the bridge fell down. Those men want the city destroyed. They think it's grown too big and unwieldy already. That its dark, squalid slums are overriding all its civilized boroughs. And you know it's the poor who will suffer the most. The rich can ride out to the country and stay at their summer estates, where they'll have clean air and clean water until spring. The poor will die in droves. Listen, you two. The people who run this country care more about the pride of the British Empire than they do mild inconveniences. And they'll let the city collapse before they bow to the demands of what they see as a handful of babblers."
"Say what you mean," said Victoire.
"Of foreigners."
"That's quite a sense of pride," said Robin.
"I know," said Letty. "It's what I grew up with. I know how deep it runs. Believe me on this, you have no idea how much they're willing to bleed for the sake of their pride. These men let Westminster Bridge fall. What else can you threaten them with?"
Silence, then. Westminster Bridge was the trump card. What rebuttal could they offer?
"So you mean to talk us into our deaths?"
Victoire said finally.
"I don't," said Letty. "I mean to save you." She blinked, and suddenly tears traced two thin, clear lines down her face. This was not an act. They knew Letty could not act. She was heartbroken, truly heartbroken. She loved them, Robin did not doubt it. At least she really believed that she loved them. She wanted them safe and sound. Only her version of a successful resolution was to put them behind bars. "I didn't want any of this," she said. "I just want things to go back to the way they were. We had a future together, all of us."
Robin bit back a laugh.
"What did you imagine?"
he asked quietly.
"That we would keep eating lemon biscuits together while this country declared war on our motherlands?"
"They're not your motherlands," said Letty.
"They don't have to be."
"They do have to be," said Victoire. "Because we'll never be British. How can you still not understand?" That identity is foreclosed to us. We are foreign because this nation has marked us so. And as long as we're punished daily for our ties to our homelands, we might as well defend them. No, Letty. We can't maintain this fantasy. The only one who can do that is you.
Letty's face tightened. The truce was over. The walls were up. They had reminded her why she'd abandoned them, which was that she could never, really, properly be one of them. And Letty, if she could not belong to a place, would rather tear the whole thing down.
You realize that if I walk out of here with a no, they'll come in prepared to kill all of you.
But they can't do that. Victoire glanced at Robin, as if for confirmation. The whole point of this strike was that they need us. They can't risk us.
Please understand, Letty's voice hardened. You gave them a headache. Well done, you. But you are, in the end, expendable. All of you. Losing you will be a minor setback, but the Imperial Project involves more than a few scholars, and it will span more than a few decades. This nation is trying to achieve what no other civilization has done throughout history. And if mowing you down means a temporary delay, then they'll do it. They'll train new translators.
They won't, said Robin. No one will work for them after this.
Letty scoffed.
Of course they will. We knew very well what they were up to, didn't we? They told us on the very first day. And we still loved it here.
They'll always be able to find new translators. They'll relearn what they lost. And they'll just keep going because no one else will be there to stop them.
She seized Robin's hand. The gesture was so sudden, so shocking, that he didn't have time to pull away.
Her skin was icy cold, a grip so strong he was afraid she might snap his fingers off.
You can't change things if you're dead, Birdie.
Violently, he shook her off. Don't call me Birdie!
She pretended not to hear this.
Don't lose sight of your end goal. If you want to fix the Empire, your best course is to work within it.
Like you do? Asked Robin. Like Sterling Jones did?
At least we're not wanted by the police. At least we have the freedom to act.
Do you think the state's ever going to change, Letty? I mean, have you ever thought about what happens if you win?
She shrugged. We will win a quick, bodiless war. And after that, all the silver in the world.
And then what? Your machines get faster, wages fall, inequality increases, poverty increases, everything Antony predicted will happen. The revels will be unsustainable. What then?
I suppose we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Letty's lip curled.
As it were.
You won't, said Robin. There's no solution. You're on a train that you can't jump off, don't you see? This can't end well for anyone. Liberation for us means liberation for you as well.
Or, said Letty, it'll just keep going faster and faster. And we'll let it. Because if the train's speeding past everyone else, we may as well be riding it. There was no arguing with that. But if they were being honest with themselves, there had never been any arguing with Letty.
This isn't worth it,
Letty continued.
All those bodies in the streets, and for what? To make a point? Ideological righteousness is well and fine, but by God, Robin, you're letting people die for a cause you must know is bound to fail. And you will fail,
she continued relentlessly.
You don't have the numbers. You don't have the public support. You don't have the votes, and you don't have the momentum. You don't understand how determined the Empire is to reclaim its silver. You think you're prepared to make sacrifices? They will do anything it takes to smoke you out. You should know that they don't plan on losing all of you. They just need to kill some of you. They'll take the rest prisoner, and then they'll break your strike.
Tell me, if you'd just seen your friends die, if you had a gun pointed at your head, wouldn't you go back to work? They've already arrested Chakravarti, you know. They'll torture him until he cooperates.
Go on, tell me. When push comes to shove, how many people in this tower are going to stick to their principles?
We're not all as spineless as you, said Victoire.
They're here, aren't they? They're with us. I ask again. How long do you think that'll last? They haven't yet lost one of their own. How do you think they'll feel when the first body of your revolution hits the floor? When there's a gun to their temple?
Victoire pointed to the door.
Get out.
I'm trying to save you,
Letty insisted. I'm your last shot at salvation. Surrender now, come out peacefully and cooperate with restoration.
You won't be in prison for long. They need you. You said it yourself. You'll be back at Babel in no time, doing the work you always dreamed of. It's the best offer you'll get. That's all I came here to say. Take it, or you'll die.
Then we'll die, Robin almost said, but stopped himself. He couldn't sentence everyone upstairs to death. She knew that. She had them beat. There was no arguing their way out of this. She had them utterly cornered. There was nothing she hadn't foreseen. No more tricks to pull out of their sleeves. Westminster Bridge had fallen. What more could they threaten? He hated what came out of his lips next. It felt like surrender. Like bowing. Can't decide for them all. And call a meeting. Letty's lip curled. Pull the room. Get a consensus with whatever little form of democracy you've got running here. She placed the white flag down on a table. But have an answer for us by dawn. She turned to go. Robin rushed forward. Letty, wait! She paused, one hand on the door.
Why, Remy?
He asked. She froze. She looked like a statue. Under the moonlight, her cheeks shone a pale, marble white. This was how he should always have seen her, he thought. Cold, bloodless, devoid of anything that made her a living, breathing, loving, hurting human being. You aimed, he said. You pulled the trigger. And you're a terribly good shot, Letty.
Why him? What did Remy ever do to you?
He knew what. They both knew, there was no question. But Robin wanted to give it a name. Wanted to make sure Letty knew what he knew. Wanted to pull the memory fresh between them, sharp and vicious, because he could see the pain it brought to Letty's eyes, and because she deserved it. Letty stared at him for a long time. She did not move, save for the rapid rise and fall of her chest. When she spoke, her voice was high and cold.
I didn't,
she said. And Robin could tell from the way she narrowed her eyes and drawled her words, punctuating them just so, like daggers, what was going to come next. His own words, thrown back in his face.
I didn't think at all. I panicked, and then I killed him.
Murder's not that simple, he said.
It turns out it is, Birdie.
She cast him a scornful look.
Isn't that how we got here? We loved you,
Victoire whispered.
Letty, we would have died for you.
Letty did not answer. She turned on her heel, threw the door open, and fled into the night. The door slammed shut, and then there was silence. They weren't ready to take the news upstairs. They didn't know what they could say.
You think she means it?
Robin asked finally.
She absolutely does, said Victoire. Letty doesn't flinch.
Then do we let her win?
How?
Victoire asked slowly.
Do you think we make her lose?
An awful weight hung between them. Robin knew his answer, only not how to utter it. Victoire knew everything in his heart except this. It was the one thing he'd concealed from her, in part because he did not want to make her share this burden, and in part because he was afraid of how she might respond. Her eyes narrowed.
Robin?
We destroy the tower, he said. And we destroy ourselves. She didn't flinch. She only seemed to deflate, as if she'd been waiting for confirmation. He hadn't pretended as well as he thought. She'd expected this from him.
You can't.
There's a way. Robin misinterpreted her words on purpose, hoping rather that her objection was one of logistics. You know there is. They showed us at the very beginning. Victoire went very still then. Robin knew what she was imagining. The shrill, vibrating bar in Professor Playfair's hands, screaming as if in pain, shattering into a thousand sharp, glinting pieces. Multiply that over and over. Instead of a bar, imagine a tower. Imagine a country. It's a chain reaction, he whispered. It'll finish the job on its own, remember? Playfair showed us how it's done. If it so much as touches another bar, the effect transmits across the metal. It doesn't stop.
It just keeps going until it renders all the silver unusable.
How much silver lined the walls of Babel?
When this was over,
all those bars would be worthless.
Then the cooperation of the translators wouldn't matter. Their facilities would be gone. Their library, gone. The Grammaticus, gone. Their resonance rods, their silver, useless, gone.
How long have you been planning this?
Victoire demanded.
Since the beginning, he said. I hate you.
It's the only way we have left to win.
It's your suicide plan,
she said angrily.
And don't tell me that it's anything but. You want this. You've always wanted this.
But that was just it, Robin thought.
How did he explain the weight crushing his chest? The constant inability to breathe?
I think ever since Rami and Griffin... No, ever since Canton, I...
He swallowed.
I felt I didn't have the right. Don't say that. It's true. There were better men, and they died.
Robin, that's not how it works.
And what did I do? I lived a life I shouldn't have. I had what millions of people didn't. All that suffering, Victoire. And the whole time, I was drinking champagne.
Don't you dare! She raised a hand as if to slap him. Don't tell me you're just some fragile academic who can't handle the weight of the world now that you've seen it. That's absolute tripe, Robin. You're not some foppish dandy who faints at the first mention of suffering. You know what those men are? They're cowards, romantics, idiots who never did a thing to change the world they found so upsetting, hiding away because they felt so guilty.
Guilty, he repeated. Guilty. That's exactly what I am. Rami told me once that I didn't care about doing the right thing, that I just wanted to take the easy way out.
He was right, she said fiercely. It's the coward's way, you know it.
No, listen.
He gripped her hands. They were trembling. She tried to pull away, but he squeezed her fingers between his. He needed her with him. Needed to make her understand, before she hated him forever for abandoning her to the dark.
He's right. You're right. I know it. I'm trying to say it. He was right. I'm so sorry. But I don't know how to go on.
Day by day, Birdie.
Her eyes filled with tears.
You go on day by day. Just as we've been doing. It's not hard.
No, it's... Victoire, I can't.
He didn't want to cry. If he started crying, then all his words would disappear, and he would never manage to say what he needed to. He ploughed through before his tears could catch up.
I want to believe in the future we're fighting for. But it's not there. It's just not there. And I can't take things day by day when I'm too horrified by the thought of tomorrow. I'm underwater. And I've been underwater for so long. And I wanted a way out. But couldn't find one that didn't feel like some... some great abdication of responsibility. But this... this is my way out.
She shook her head. She was weeping freely now. Both of them were.
Don't say this to me. Someone's got to speak the words. Someone has to stay. Then aren't you going to ask me to stay with you? Oh, Victoire.
What else was there to say? He could not ask this of her, and she knew he would never dare. Yet the question hung between them, unanswered. Victoire's gaze was fixed steadily on the window. At the black lawn outside, at the torchlit barricades, she cried, steadily and silently. The tears kept streaming down her cheeks, and she kept wiping them away, pointlessly. He couldn't tell what she was thinking. This was the first time, since all this had started, that he couldn't read her heart. At last, she took a deep breath and lifted her head. Without turning around, she asked,
Did you ever read that poem, The Abolitionist's Love?
That one by Bicknell and Day?
It's called The Dying Negro.
Robin had read it, in fact, in an abolitionist pamphlet he'd picked up in London. He'd found it striking. He still remembered it in detail. It described the story of an African man who, facing the prospects of capture and return to slavery, killed himself instead.
Armed with thy sad last gift, the power to die, Thy shafts, stern fortune, now I can defy. Thomas Day and John Bicknell, 1775.
Robin had found it romantic and moving at the time, but now, seeing Victoire's expression, he realized it was anything but.
I did,
he said. It was tragic.
You have to die to get their pity,
said Victoire.
We have to die for them to find us noble. Our deaths are thus great acts of rebellion. A wretched lament that highlights their inhumanity. Our deaths become their battle cry. But I don't want to die, Robin.
Her throat hitched.
I don't want to die. I don't want to be their Imoina, their Orinoco.
In The White Englishwoman, Aphra Behn's 1688 romantic novel Orinoco, the African prince Orinoco kills his lover, Imoinda, to save her from being violated by the English military forces against whom they are revolting. Orinoco is later captured, bound to a post, quartered and dismembered. Orinoco and its theatrical adaptation by Thomas Southern were received at the time as a great romance.
I don't want to be that tragic, lovely lack of figure. I want to live.
She fell against his shoulder. He wrapped his arms around her and held her tight, rocking back and forth.
I want to live,
she repeated,
and live and thrive and survive them. I want a future. I don't think death is a reprieve. I think it's just the end. It forecloses everything. A future where I might be happy and free. And it's not about being brave. It's about wanting another chance. Even if all I did was run away, even if I never lifted a finger to help anyone else as long as I lived, at least I would get to be happy. At least the world might be all right, just for a day. Just for me. Is that selfish?
Her shoulders crumpled. Robin held her tight against him. What an anchor she was, he thought. An anchor he did not deserve. She was his rock. His light. The sole presence that had kept him going. And he wished, that was enough for him to hold on to. Be selfish, he whispered. Be brave. Chapter 33. The hour of departure has arrived, and we go our ways. I to die, and you to live. Which is better, God only knows. Plato, Apology. Translation Benjamin Jowett.
The whole tower?
Asked Professor Kraft. She was the first to speak. The rest of them stared at Robin and Victoire in varying states of disbelief. And even Professor Kraft seemed like she was still wrapping her mind around the idea as she spoke its implications out loud.
That's decades, centuries of research, that's everything buried, lost. Oh, but who knows how many...
She trailed off. And the ramifications for England will be much worse, said Robin. This country runs on silver. Silver pumps through its blood. England can't live without it.
They'd build it all back, eventually, yes, said Robin.
But not before the rest of the world has time to muster a defence.
And China?
They won't go to war. They won't be able to. Silver powers the gunships, you see. Silver feeds the navy. For months after this, perhaps years, they'll no longer be the strongest nation in the world. And what happens next is anyone's guess. The future would be fluid. It was just as Griffin had predicted. One individual choice made at just the right time. This was how they defied momentum. This was how they altered the tracks of history. And in the end, the answer had been so obvious. To simply refuse to participate. To remove their labor. And the fruits of their labor, permanently, from the offering.
That can't be it,
said Juliana. Her voice trailed up at the end. It was a question, not a declaration.
There's got to be... There must be some other way.
They're storming us at dawn, said Robin. They'll shoot a few of us to make an example, and then hold the rest of us at gunpoint until we start repairing the damage. They'll put us in chains, and they'll put us to work.
But the barricades... The barricades will fall,
whispered Victoire. They're just walls, Juliana,
Walls can be destroyed. Silence first, then resignation, then acceptance. They already lived in the impossible. What more was the fall of the most eternal thing they'd ever known?
Then I suppose we'll have to get out fast, said Ibrahim, right after the chain reaction starts.
But you can't get out fast, Robin almost said before he stopped himself. The rejoinder was obvious. They couldn't get out fast, because they couldn't get out at all. A single incantation would not do. If they were not thorough, the tower might collapse part way, but its remains would be salvageable, easily repurposed. The only things they would have inflicted would be expense and frustration. They would have suffered for nothing. No, for this plan to work, to strike a blow against Empire from which it could not recover, they had to stay, and say the words again and again, and activate as many nodes of destruction as they could. But how did he tell a roomful of people that they needed to die? He started, but the words stuck in his throat. He didn't have to explain. They'd all figured it out. They were all reaching the same conclusion, one after the other, and the change in their eyes was heartbreaking. I'm going through with it, he said. I'm not asking all of you to come with me. Abel can get you out if you won't, but all I mean is, I can't do it by myself. Victoire looked away, arms crossed. We won't need everyone, he continued, desperate to fill the silence with words because, perhaps the more he spoke it, the less awful it sounded. I suppose a diversity of languages would be good to amplify the effect, and of course we'll want people standing in all corners of the tower because... His throat pulsed. But we don't need everyone. I'll stay, said Professor Kraft. Thank you, Professor. She gave him a wobbly smile. I suppose I wasn't going to get tenure on the other side of this anyhow. He saw them all making the same calculation then. The finality of death against the persecution, prison, and possible execution they would face on the outside. Surviving Babel did not necessarily mean survival. And he could see them asking themselves if they could come to terms now with their own deaths, if that would, in the end, be easier. You're not afraid? Morgana told him, asked him. No, said Robin. But that was all he could say. He didn't understand his heart himself. He felt resolved. But perhaps that was only the adrenaline. Perhaps his fear and hesitation were only pushed temporarily behind a flimsy wall which would shatter upon closer examination. No, I'm not. I'm ready. But we won't need everyone. Possibly the younger students, Professor Kraft cleared her throat. The ones who don't know any silver working, I mean. There's no reason. I want to stay. Ibrahim cast Yuliana an anxious glance. I don't want to run. Yuliana, pale as paper, said nothing. There is a way out, Yusuf asked Robin. There is. Abel's men can ferry you out of the city, they've promised. They're waiting for us. But you'll have to go as soon as you can, and then you'll have to run. I don't think you'll ever be able to stop running.
There are no terms of amnesty?
Morgana asked. There are if you work for them, said Robin. If you help them restore things back to how they were. Letty made that offer. She wanted you to know. But you'll always be under their thumb. They'll never let you go. She intimated as much. They'll own you, and they'll make you feel grateful for it. At this, Yuliana reached out and took Ibrahim's hand. He squeezed her fingers. Both their knuckles turned white, and the sight of this was so intimate that Robin blinked and glanced away.
But we can still run, said Yusuf.
You can still run, said Robin. You wouldn't be safe anywhere in this country.
But we could go home.
Victoire's voice was so soft that they could barely hear her.
We can go home.
Yusuf nodded, considered this a moment, and then moved to stand beside her. And it was that simple. The determination of who fled and who died. Robin, Professor Kraft, Morgana, Ibrahim and Yuliana on one side, Yusuf and Victoire on the other. No one pleaded or begged, and no one changed their minds. So, Ibrahim looked very small.
When?
Dawn,
said Robin. They're coming at dawn. Then we'd better stack the bars, said Professor Kraft, and we'd better place them properly, if we only get one go.
What's the word? Abel Goodfellow demanded. They're inching right up to us.
Send your men home, Robin said.
What?
As quick as you can. Get out of the barricades and go on the run. There's not much time. The guards, they don't care about casualties anymore. Abel registered this, then nodded.
Who's coming with us?
Just two. Yusuf, Victor. They're saying their goodbyes. They'll be ready soon. Robin pulled a wrapped parcel from inside his jacket.
There's also this.
Abel must have read something in his face, heard something in his voice, because his eyes narrowed.
And what are the rest of you up to in there?
I shouldn't tell you. Abel raised the parcel.
Is this a suicide note?
It's a written record, said Robin, of everything that's happened in this tower, what we stood for. There's a second copy, but in case it gets lost. I know you'll find some way to get this out there. Print it all over England. Tell them what we did. Make them remember us. Abel looked like he wanted to argue, but Robin shook his head. Please, my mind's made up, and there's not much time. I can't explain this, and I think it's best if you don't ask. Abel watched him for a moment, then seemed to think better of what it was he was about to say.
You'll end this.
We're going to try. Robin's chest felt very tight. He was so exhausted. He wanted to curl up on the ground and go to sleep. He wanted this to be over. But I can't tell you more tonight. I just need you to go. Abel thrust out his arm.
And this, I suppose, is goodbye.
Goodbye. Robin grasped his palm and shook it. Oh, and the blankets, I forgot.
Think nothing of it.
Abel wrapped his other hand over Robin's. His grip was so warm, solid. Robin felt a catch in his throat. He was grateful that Abel was making this easy, that he hadn't forced him to justify himself. He had to go swiftly, resolute to the very end.
Good luck, Robin Swift.
Abel squeezed his hand.
God be with you.
They spent the hours before dawn arranging hundreds of silver bars into pyramids at vulnerable points around the tower, around the base supports, beneath the windows, along the walls and bookshelves, and in veritable pyramids around the grammaticas. They could not predict the scope, the scale of the destruction, but they would prepare for it as well as they could, would make it near impossible to salvage any material from the remains. Victoire and Yusuf left an hour after midnight. Their farewells were brief, constrained. It was an impossible parting. There was too much and yet nothing to say, and there was a sense that everyone was holding back for fear of opening the floodgates. If they said too little, they would regret it forever. If they said too much, they'd never bring themselves to part. Safe travels, Robin whispered, embracing Victoire. She choked out a laugh.
Yes, thank you.
They clung to each other for a long time. Long enough that at last, once everyone had left to give them privacy, they were the only two standing in the lobby. Finally, she stepped back, glanced round, eyes darting back and forth as if she was unsure whether to speak. You don't think this will work, said Robin.
I didn't say that.
You're thinking it.
I'm just terrified that we'll make this grand statement.
She lifted her hands, let them fall.
And they'll see it only as a temporary setback. Something to recover from. That they'll never understand what we meant.
For what it's worth, I don't think they were ever going to listen.
No. I don't think they were.
She was crying again.
Oh, Robin. I don't know what to...
Just go, he said. And write to Rami's parents, will you? They ought to know. She nodded, gave him one last tight squeeze, and then darted out the door to the green where Yusuf and Abel's men were waiting. One last wave, Victoire's stricken expression under the moonlight, and then they were gone. Then there was nothing to do but wait for the end. How did one make peace with one's own death? According to the accounts of the Crito, the Phaedo, and the Apology, Socrates went to his death without distress, with such preternatural calm
that he refused multiple entreaties to escape. In fact, he'd been so cheerfully blasé, so convinced that dying was the just thing to do, that he beat his friends over their heads with his reasoning, in that insufferably righteous way of his, even as they burst into tears. Robin had been so struck upon his first foray into the Greek texts by Socrates' utter indifference to his end. And surely it was better, easier to die with such good cheer, no doubts, no fears, one's heart at rest. He could, in theory, believe it. Often, he had thought of death as a reprieve. He had not stopped dreaming of it since the day Letty shot Rami. He entertained himself with ideas of heaven as paradise, of green hills and brilliant skies where he and Rami could sit and talk and watch an eternal sunset. But such fantasies did not comfort him so much as the idea that all death meant was nothingness, that everything would just stop. The pain, the anguish, the awful, suffocating grief. If nothing else, surely death meant peace. Still, facing the moment, he was terrified. They wound up sitting on the floor in the lobby, taking comfort in the silence of the group, listening to each other breathe. Professor Kraft tried, haltingly, to comfort them, surveying her memory for ancient words on this most human of dilemmas. She spoke to them of Seneca's
Troades,
of Lucan's Voltaeus, of the martyrdom of Cato and Socrates. She quoted to them Cicero, Horace, and Pliny the Elder.
Death is nature's greatest good. Death is a better state. Death frees the immortal soul. Death is transcendence. Death is an act of bravery, a glorious act of defiance.
Seneca the Younger, describing Cato,
Una manu latam,
libertati, viam faciet.
With one hand he will make an open path for freedom.
Virgil, describing Dido,
Sic sic iuvat, ir sub umbras.
Thus it helps to go beneath the shadows.
None of it really sank in. None of it moved them, for theorizing about death never could. Words and thoughts always ran up against the immovable limit of the imminent, permanent ending. Still, her voice, steady and unflinching, was a comfort. They let it wash over their ears, lulling them in these final hours. Yuliana glanced out of the window.
They're moving across the green.
It's not dawn, said Robin.
They're moving, she said simply.
Well then, said Professor Kraft,
we'd better get on with it.
They stood. They would not face their ends together, each man and woman to their station, to the pyramids of silver distributed on different floors and different wings across the building, positioned thus to reduce the chances that any part of the tower might remain intact. When the walls tumbled down upon them, they would be alone. And this was why, as the moment drew near, it felt so impossible to part. Tears streamed down Ibrahim's face.
I don't want to die, he whispered. There must be some other. I don't want to die.
They all felt the same, a desperate hope for some chance of escape. In these last moments, the seconds weren't enough. In theory, this decision they'd made was something beautiful. In theory, they would be martyrs, heroes, the ones who'd pushed history off its path. But none of that was a comfort. In the moment, all that mattered was that death was painful and frightening and permanent, and none of them wanted to die. But even as they trembled, not one of them broke. It was only a wish, after all. And the army was on its way. Let's not tarry, said Professor Kraft, and they ascended the stairs to their respective floors. Robin remained in the center of the lobby, beneath the broken chandelier, surrounded by 8 pyramids of silver bars as tall as he stood. He took a deep breath, watching the second hand tick across the clock above the door. Oxford's bell towers had long gone mute. As the minute drew near, the only indication of the time was the synchronized ticking of the grandfather clocks, all positioned in the same place on every floor. They'd chosen 6 o'clock on the dot, an arbitrary time, but they needed a final moment, an immovable fact on which to fix their will. 1 minute to 6. He loosed a shaky breath. His thoughts flew about, casting desperately for anything to think about that was not this. He landed not on coherent memories, but on hyper-specific details. The salty weight of the air at sea. The length of Victoire's eyelashes. The hitch in Rami's voice just before he burst out into full-bellied laughter. He clung to them. Lingered there as long as he could. Refused to let his mind go anywhere else. 20 seconds. The warm grittiness of a scone at Volts. Mrs. Piper's sweet, flowery hugs. Buttery lemon biscuits melting into nectar on his tongue. 10. The bitter taste of ale. And the biting sting of Griffin's laughter. The sour stink of opium. Dinner at the old library. Fragrant curry and the burnt bottoms of oversalted potatoes. Laughter. Loud and desperate and hysterical. 5. Rami smiling. Rami reaching. Robin placed his hand on the nearest pyramid, closed his eyes and breathed. Fan Yi. Translate. The sharp ring echoed through the room. A siren screech reverberating through his bones. A death rattle, resounding all the way up and down the tower. For everyone had carried out their duty. No one had barked. Robin exhaled, trembling. No space for hesitation. No time for fear. He moved his hand to the bars in the next pile and whispered again. Fan Yi. Translate. Again. Fan Yi. Translate. And again. Fan Yi. Translate. He felt a shifting beneath his feet. He saw the walls trembling. Books tumbled off the shelves. Above him, something groaned. He thought he'd be scared. He thought he'd be fixated on the pain, on how it might feel when 8,000 tons of rubble collapsed on him at once, on whether death might be instant, or whether it might come in horribly small increments when his hands and limbs were crushed, when his lungs struggled to expand in an ever tinier space. But what struck him most just then was the beauty. The bars were singing, shaking, trying, he thought, to express some unutterable truth about themselves, which was that translation was impossible, that the realm of pure meaning they captured and manifested would and could not ever be known, that the enterprise of this tower had been impossible from inception. For how could there ever be an Adamic language? The thought now made him laugh. There was no innate, perfectly comprehensible language. There was no candidate, not English, not French, that could bully and absorb enough to become one. Language was just difference. 1,000 different ways of seeing, of moving through the world. No, 1,000 worlds within one. And translation, a necessary endeavor, however futile, to move between them. He went back to his first morning in Oxford, climbing a sunny hill with Rami, picnic basket in hand, elderflower cordial, warm brioche, sharp cheese, a chocolate tart for dessert. The air that day smelt like a promise. All of Oxford shone like an illumination, and he was falling in love. "It's so odd," Robin said. Back then, they'd already passed the point of honesty. They spoke to one another unfiltered, unafraid of the consequences. "It's like I've known you forever." "Me too," Rami said. "And that makes no sense," said Robin, drunk already, though there was no alcohol in the cordial. "Because I've known you for less than a day, and yet..." "I think," said Rami, "it's because when I speak, you listen. Because you're fascinating." "Because you're a good translator." Rami leaned back on his elbows. "That's just what translation is, I think. That's all speaking is. Listening to the other, and trying to see past your own biases to glimpse what they're trying to say.
showing yourself to the world, and hoping someone else understands.
The ceiling was starting to crumble. First streams of pebbles, then whole chunks of marble, exposing planks, breaking beams. The shelves collapsed. Sunlight streaked the room where before there had been no windows. Robin looked up and saw Babel, falling in and upon him, and beyond that, the sky before dawn. He shut his eyes. But he'd waited for death to come before. He remembered this now. He knew death. Not so abruptly. No. Not so violently. But the memory of waiting to fade was still locked in his bones. Memories of a stale, hot room. Of paralysis. Of dreaming about the end. He remembered the stillness. The peace. As the windows smashed in, Robin shut his eyes and imagined his mother's face. She smiles. She says his name.
Epilogue. Victoire.
Victoire de Grève has always been good at surviving. The key she has learned is refusing to look back. Even as she races north on horseback through the Cotswolds, head bent against the whipping branches, some part of her wants to be in the tower, with her friends, feeling the walls come down around them. If they must die, she wants them to be buried together. But survival demands severing the cord. Survival demands she look only to the future. Who knows what will happen now? What happened in Oxford today is unthinkable. Its ramifications unimaginable. There is no historical precedent for this. The juncture is shot. History, for once, is fluid. But Victoire is familiar with the unthinkable. The liberation of her motherland was unthinkable even as it happened, for no one in France or England, not even the most radical proponents of universal freedom, believed that slaves, creatures they never thought fell under their categories of rational, rights-holding, enlightened men, would demand their own liberation. 2 months after news broke of the August 1791 uprising, Jean-Pierre Brissot, himself a founding member of the Amis des Noirs, announced to the French Assembly that this news must be false, for as anyone knew, slaves were simply incapable of such rapid, coordinated, defiant action. A year into the revolution, many still believed that soon the unrest would be quelled, that things would go back to normal. For normal meant white dominance over blacks. They were, of course, wrong. But who in living history ever understands their part in the tapestry? For the better part of her life, Victoire was not even aware she hailed from the world's first black republic. Here is all she knew before Hermes. She was born in Haiti, in 1820, the same year that King Henry Christophe, fearing a coup, took his own life. His wife and daughters fled to the home of an English benefactor in Suffolk. Victoire's mother, a maid of the exiled queen, went with them. She referred to this always as their great flight and, once she set foot in Paris, refused ever to think again of Haiti as home. Victoire's understanding of Haitian history is of curses in the night, of a magnificent palace named Sanssouci, home to the first black king in the New World, of men with guns, of vague political disagreements she does not understand that, somehow, uprooted her life and sent her across the Atlantic. As a child, she knew her motherland as a place of violence and barbaric power struggles, for that is how they spoke of it in France, and that was what her exiled mother chose to believe. "We are lucky," whispered her mother, "that we survived it." But her mother did not survive France. Victoire never learned how her mother, a freeborn woman, was sent from Suffolk to work in the household of a retired Parisian academic, Professor Émile Desjardins. She does not know what promises her mother's friends made her, whether or not money changed hands. She knows only that in Paris, at the Desjardins estate, they were not allowed to leave, for here forms of slavery still existed, as they did all over the world. A twilight condition, the rules unwritten but implied. and when her mother fell ill, the Desjardins did not send for a doctor. They merely closed the door to her sick room and waited outside until a maid went in, felt for her breath and pulse, and announced she had expired. Then they locked Victoire in a cupboard and did not let her out, for fear the illness would catch. But the contagion took the rest of the household regardless, and once again, the doctors were powerless to do anything but watch it run its course. Victoire survived. Professor Desjardins' wife survived. His daughter survived. The professor himself died, and with him, Victoire's only connection to the people who purported to love her mother, and had yet somehow sold her away. The house fell into disrepair. Madame Desjardins, a tight-faced blonde woman, kept bad accounts and spent prodigiously. Money was tight. They fired the maid. Why keep one, they argued, when they had Victoire? Overnight, Victoire became responsible for dozens of tasks. Keeping the fire, polishing the silver, dusting the rooms, serving the tea. But these were not tasks she'd been trained to fulfill. She'd been raised to read and compose and interpret, not manage a household. And for this, they scolded and beat her. She found no comfort from Madame Desjardins' two little daughters, who took great delight in announcing to house guests that Victoire was an orphan they'd rescued from Africa. "From Zanzibar," they would sing in unison. "Zanzibar." But it was not so bad. It was not so bad, they told her, compared with her native Haiti, which was overrun with crime, which was being driven to poverty and anarchy by an incompetent and illegitimate regime. "You are lucky," they said, "to be here with us, where things are safe and civilized." This she believed. She had no way of knowing anything else. She might have run away, but Professor and Madame Desjardins had kept her so sheltered, so isolated from the world outside, that she had no idea she had the legal right to be free. Victoire had grown up in the great contradiction of France, whose citizens in 1789 had issued a declaration of the rights of man, but had not abolished slavery, and had preserved the right to property, including Châtel. Liberation was a string of coincidences, of ingenuity, resourcefulness and luck. Victoire went through Professor Desjardins' letters, looking for a deed, some proof that he did own her and her mother. She never found it. But she did learn about a place named the Royal Institute of Translation, a place he'd trained at in his youth, a place he'd written to about her, in fact. He told them about the brilliant little girl in his household, about her prodigious memory and talent for Greek and Latin. He'd intended to show her around Europe on tour. Perhaps they might be interested in an interview. And so she created the conditions of her own freedom. When Professor Desjardins' friends at Oxford finally wrote back, expressing that they would be very happy to have the talented Miss de Grave at the Institute, and that they would pay the way, it felt like such an escape. But the true liberation of Victoire de Grave did not happen until she met Anthony Ribbon. It was not until her induction to the Hermes Society that she learned to call herself Haitian at all. She learned to take pride in her Creole, patchy, half-remembered, barely distinguishable from her French. Madame Desjardins used to slap her whenever she spoke in Creole. "Shut up," she would say. "I told you, you must speak French, the Frenchman's French." She also learned that to much of the rest of the world, the Haitian Revolution was not a failed experiment, but a beacon of hope. She learned revolution is, in fact, always unimaginable. It shatters the world you know. The future is unwritten, brimming with potential. The colonizers have no idea what is coming, and that makes them panic. It terrifies them. Good. It should. She's not sure where she's headed now. She has some envelopes in her coat pocket, parting words of advice from Anthony, and the code names of several contacts, friends in Mauritius, in the Seychelles, and in Paris. Perhaps one day she'll head back to France. But she's not quite ready yet. She knows there's a base in Ireland, though at the moment, she'd quite like just to be off the continent. Perhaps one day she'll go home and see, with her own eyes, the historical impossibility of free Haiti. Right now, she's boarding a ship to America, where people like her are still not free, because it was the first vessel that she could book passage on, and because she needed to get out of England as quickly as she could. She has the letter from Griffin that Robin never opened. Meanwhile, she's read it so many times. She's memorized it. She knows three names: Martlet, Oriel, and Rook. She can see in her mind's eye the final sentence, scrawled before the signatures like an afterthought. We're not the only ones. She doesn't know who these three are. She doesn't know what this sentence means. She'll find out one day, and the truth will dazzle and horrify her. But for now, they're only lovely syllables that signify all sorts of possibilities. And possibilities, hope, are the only thing she can cling to now. She has silver lining her pockets, silver in the inseams of her dress, so much silver on her person that she feels stiff and heavy when she moves. Her eyes are swollen from tears, her throat sore with stifled sobs. She has the faces of her dead friends engraved in her memory. She keeps imagining their last moments, their terror, their pain as the walls came crumbling down around them. She does not, will not let herself think of her friends as they were, alive and happy. Not Rami, torn down in his prime. Not Robin, who brought down a tower upon himself because he couldn't think of a way to keep on living. Not even Letty, who remains alive, who, if she knows Victoire lives too, will hunt her to the ends of the earth. Letty, she knows, cannot allow her to roam free. Even the idea of Victoire is a threat. It threatens the core of her very being. It is proof that she is, and always was, wrong. She won't let herself grieve that friendship, as true and terrible and abusive as it was. There will come a time for grief. There will come many nights on the voyage when the sadness is so great it threatens to tear her apart. When she regrets her decision to live. When she curses Robin for placing this burden on her. Because he was right. He was not being brave. He was not choosing sacrifice. Death is seductive. Victoire resists. She cannot weep now. She must keep moving. She must run, as fast as she can, without knowing what is on the other side. She has no illusions about what she will encounter. She knows she will face immeasurable cruelty. She knows her greatest obstacle will be cold indifference, born of a bone-deep investment in an economic system that privileges some and crushes others. But she might find allies. She might find a way forward. Antony called victory an inevitability. Antony believed the material contradictions of England would tear it apart, that their movement would succeed because the revels of the empire were simply unsustainable. This, he argued, was why they had a chance. Victoire knows better. Victory is not assured. Victory may be in the portents, but it must be urged there by violence, by suffering, by martyrs, by blood. Victory is wrought by ingenuity, persistence, and sacrifice. Victory is a game of inches, of historical contingencies where everything goes right because they have made it go right. She cannot know what shape that struggle will take. There are so many battles to be fought, so many fights on so many fronts, in India, in China, in the Americas, all linked together by the same drive to exploit that which is not white and English. She knows only that she will be in it at every unpredictable turn, will fight until her dying breath.
Mandimwen yon tiku, anko madiu,
she told Antony once, when he'd first asked her what she thought of Hermes, if she thought they might succeed. He'd tried his best to pass Creole with what he knew of French, then he'd given up.
What's that mean?
I don't know, said Victoire.
At least, we say it when we don't know the answer, or don't care to share the answer.
And what's it literally mean?
She'd winked at him.
Ask me a little later, and I'll tell you.
Thank you. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Babel, or The Necessity of Violence, an Arcane History of the Oxford Translators Revolution by R.F. Kuang, performed by Chris Lucum-Hoy and Billy Fulford-Brown, and presented by William Morrow and Harper Audio. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Executive producer, Abigail J. Nova. Text copyright 2022 by Rebecca Kuang. Production copyright 2022 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.